from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, he was found in a hole. Gave up without a fight. Had a pistol on him. Unshaven, of course. Haggard. Looking kind of glum. We have captured Osama bin Laden. The war on terrorism. What? Sorry. We've captured Saddam Hussein. On the other hand, plans to deploy the first battalion of Iraq's new army are in doubt this week because a third of the soldiers trained by the U.S.-led occupation authority have quit the army, according to defense officials earlier this week. Touted as a key to Iraq's future, the 700-man battalion lost some 250 men over recent weeks as they were preparing to begin operations this month. A third has apparently resigned. We found Saddam Hussein. We can't find the third of the army. Apparently resigned. We're looking into that, says Lieutenant Colonel James Casella, in order to ensure that we can recruit and retain high-quality people for a new Iraqi army. The battalion was highly celebrated when the newly retrained soldiers, marching to the beat of a U.S. Army band, completed a 9-week basic training course in early October. The graduates were to be the core of an army that will defend the country and not oppose it, said Paul Bremer. It was uncertain exactly why a third abandoned their new jobs, though some had complained that the starting salary was too low. The Chicago Tribune quoted officials in Baghdad saying soldiers were angry after comparing their pay with the salaries of other forces. Iraqi police are paid $60 a month, and the Civil Defense Corps, $50. The privates in the Army are being paid $60 a month. Others may have feared threats from insurgents. It was also unclear whether what remains of the battalion would be sent out for duty, and Bremer was said to be reviewing the salaries. On the other hand, British troops invading Iraq were deprived of vital equipment, including body armor and protection against chemical or biological attack, as well as such basic items as desert boots and clothing. This according to a devastating report on the failure to prepare the British Army properly for the war. Remember, we had those stories about the British soldiers borrowing the boots of the Iraqi soldiers? That was during the war. The report by the Parliament's public spending watchdog discloses the troops were so desperate they were driven to carry out a considerable degree of misappropriation, a quote, to get their hands on equipment they needed. The watchdog describes an extraordinary catalog of problems. This is the British Army now. Commanders unaware of where equipment was stored, life-saving plates for body armor disappearing, and weapons turning up so late that soldiers did not have enough time to train with them. Washington Post also said this week that the United States troops didn't have sufficient body armor. But this is the British Army. The report also states many troops were not protected against chemical weapons. They weren't protected against... We weren't a particularly damaging finding in the light of the weight and publicity the British government gave to claims in its intelligence dossier that Iraqi forces could attack Western soldiers with chemical weapons within 45 minutes of an order to do so. This contradicts claims by the Defense Secretary, Jeff Hoon, that all was well on the supply front before and during the Iraq War. A quarter of all soldiers in one brigade, the Desert Rats, had black boots and green uniforms rather than desert camouflage throughout the war. And, on the other hand, the last big triumph we experienced recently, President Bush's secret Thanksgiving Day trip to Baghdad, has now come under criticism by the British Air Traffic Controllers Union. It's a union. What do they know? For threatening the safety of other travelers and exposing a weakness in the system that could be exploited by terrorists. David Luxton, head of the union, said that Bush's surprise holiday flight to visit American troops in Iraq, during which his Boeing 747 was falsely identified to air traffic control as a Gulfstream 5 jet for security reasons, broke international regulations. The overriding concern is if the president's men could dupe the air traffic control, what's to stop a highly organized terrorist group from duping air traffic control, he asked. Luxton said the journey was in breach of regulations against filing false flight plans set by the International Civil Aviation Organization, which apply to military planes using civilian airspace. He said that by misidentifying itself, it endangered itself and other air traffic. But on the other hand, we've captured Saddam Hussein. Hello, welcome to the show.
Senor, senor, How long must I keep my eyes glued to the door? Will there be any comfort there, senor? Hanging from around her neck. There's a marching band still playing in that vacant lot. Well, she held me in her arms one time and said, forget me not. Senor, senor, I can see that painted wagon, smell the tickle of the dragon. I can't stand the suspense here anymore. Can you tell me who to contact here, senor? Well, the last thing I remember before I stripped it in was a trailer full of fools bogged down in the magnetic field. And a gypsy with a broken flag and a flashing ring. He says, son, this ain't a dream no more, it's a real thing. Senor, senor, you know their heart's hard as leather. Give me a minute, let me get it together. I gotta pick myself up off the floor. I'm ready when you are, senor. Don't make sense to me no more. Can you tell me what we're waiting for, senor? It seems like I've been down this road before. Is there any truth to that, senor?
Quicksand, quicksand, pulling
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another edition of the show. We've captured, I contributed some tips. I don't want to blow myself on the back a little bit too much about this, but pat myself on the horn or anything, but, you know, he might be here, he might be there, who knows. Anyway, we've captured Saddam Hussein, and everybody's celebrating. But some loose ends from last week. Dear Mr. Shearer, in your discussion of the president's Thanksgiving trip to Iraq, the question of commercial aircraft speed compared to that of Air Force One was brought up. While I don't doubt in the least the efforts at deception and misinformation coming from the White House on this subject, there's little difference in speed between Air Force One, a technologically extravagant variant of the erstwhile civilian Boeing 707-400, although cruising at the top end of the subsonic range of commercial transport jets, as all 747s are wont, and any other jet in commercial service. The supposed British Airways jet itself may well have been a Boeing 747. Speeds over the ground well in excess of 600 statute miles per hour are not uncommon in civilian jet aircraft, especially in the winter, traveling with the high-speed winds encountered at high altitude. In the Learjet I pilot for a living on a few occasions, I've seen 690 miles per hour on the ground speed display, eastbound with 100-plus knots of tailwind. So, that was just because there had been some question raised whether the British jet that was supposedly flying alongside Air Force One for a long period of that flight could possibly do so. He says, yes, it could. Other news from almost behind the bubble, but just sneaking through, made it to an inside page of the New York Times this weekend. A former Iraqi intelligence officer who was said to have met with Mohammed Atta, the suspected leader of 9/11. There's your nexus right there. If he's told American interrogators the meeting never happened. According to United States officials familiar with classified intelligence reports on the matter, Ahmad Khalil Ibrahim Samir al... Well, you know, it's got too many names for me. The former intelligence officer was taken into custody by the United States in July. Under questioning, he said that he did not meet with Mohammed Atta in Prague, according to the officials who've reviewed classified debriefing reports based on the interrogations. American officials cautioned that he may have been lying. Well, you know, that caution should accompany every statement made by everybody in public, don't you think? Yeah, I could be lying when I said I tipped. Oh, I was. Mm-hmm. I apologize. And speaking of which, it's time for the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
You know what Christmas crackers are? It's a tradition in Britain. They're these, they look like firecrackers. There's a little tug of war to open them, and then there's a gift or a surprise inside. They make a pop when they open. It's a lot of fun for everybody. A Christmas cracker company has apologized to party guests who opened their festive treats to be greeted with obscene messages. An internal inquiry has started after partygoers in Cumbria pulled their crackers to find four-letter word insults instead of traditional jokes. Party supplier Thompson Med has apologized and said it will fire those responsible. Bosses at the Bishop Auckland factory confirmed that scribbled messages were discovered in crackers used at a party at a hotel located in the community of Cockermouth. That's not one of the scribbled. No, that's the name of the community. Those attending included employees of local businesses and about 50 staff from the local borough council. Thompson Med Managing Director Paul Thompson said, "All I can do is apologize to those involved. We're looking into this and treating it very seriously." He said his company had a good reputation and had been based in the county since 1968. He has been given the batch number of crackers involved in the prank and was confident he would trace those responsible. Apologizes to the community of Cockermouth. Connecticut Governor John Rowland, whose administration has been engulfed in an assortment of federal corruption investigations for the better part of 4 years, admitted on Friday to giving false and misleading information when questioned earlier this month about work done on his private cottage. The governor initially said he paid for all the work done at the lakeside retreat. In an extraordinary statement released late Friday afternoon, That's when you time it, so nobody reads the Saturday papers. He admitted to having work done for free, having other work paid for by aides, and receiving gift from people in his employ, particularly a hot tub the governor had pointedly said he bought himself. Quote, in the limited spontaneous remarks I made about the cottage and repairs, I provided information that was incorrect and incomplete. I apologize to the citizens of Connecticut, whose trust and respect I prize above all else. I regret doing this, and I'm sorry I did it, said the governor of Connecticut. An Ohio State newspaper story relating to the football career of Coach Bob Batts has come under scrutiny, with many of the facts now proving to be untrue. Although it was confirmed that Batts was drafted into the National Football League after a collegiate career at Texas Southern University, there is no record that he played for the Chicago Bears through the 1960s. He told the Idaho State Journal he played a number of years for the Chicago Bears. He also said he had been inducted into the Texas Hall of Fame. And in the photo accompanying the story, produced a plaque representing his induction. Upon review, the newspaper has been unable to identify such an organization. The newspaper learned from a family spokesperson that the plaque was a gift from his family members. The Idaho State Journal apologizes to its readers for the misinformation, fully realizing this is an unfortunate and embarrassing situation for all involved. Another funny name, town apology, Funkstown. Near Hagerstown, Maryland, Funkstown Assistant Mayor Paul Crampton and Council Members John Phillips III and Sharon Churgut apologized at the Monday night town council meeting for missing the November meeting. I just plumb forgot last month, Phillips said. Apology in Funkstown. Sounds like a Clifford Odets play. The video game company that makes Grand Theft Auto Vice City, which features dialogue urging players to, quote, kill all the Haitians, unquote, has apologized to the Haitian community and promised to delete the offensive dialogue from new copies of the game. But a group of Haitian leaders and civil rights activists said that's not enough. They announced plans to go on the offensive against video games, saying that they're polluting young minds with inflammatory messages. The newly formed group called the Haitian American Coalition held a news conference to lay out sweeping plans to have the game removed from store shelves nationwide. They said it was nice that Rockstar Games officials issued the letter of apology for the game that advises players to kill the Haitians to earn points. They also said it was nice that Rockstar said it would remove the statement from future versions. But Boca Raton attorney Barry Silver asked whether people... Oh, remember him from the Florida recount? I do. He asked whether people would be satisfied if a food manufacturer apologized for a batch of tainted food and promised to remove the poison from future batches. Like tainted food, the game should be removed from store shelves immediately, he said. I believe he was an attorney for the Democrats. He's good. Despite trying hard to restore the malfunctioned part of Nozomi, the Japanese space exploration vehicle, the Institute of Space and Astronautical Science found the communications with Nozomi are not restored. It is very unfortunate, says the agency, to announce that we have decided to give up its injection into the orbit of Mars. Their statement continues, we would like to deeply apologize for this failure and will continue to do our best to investigate the cause. Microsoft has learned of a mistake in the Bookshelf Symbol 7 font included in the Microsoft Office System application. Due to an unintentional oversight, says Microsoft, we failed to identify, prior to the release, the presence of two swastikas within the font. We apologize for this and for any offense caused. Microsoft is taking immediate measures to remedy the issue for all customers. Microsoft has issued a patch to remove the font. Again, we apologize to those who have been offended or upset. We continue to work to improve our processes in order to prevent this type of error in the future, says Steven Sinofsky, Senior Vice President of Microsoft Office. They just didn't know that there were swastikas in the font before they were... Because their quality control is usually so good, you see, ladies. Profanity seems to be sweeping the English Christmas countryside this year. Bosses at a top new Birmingham store have been forced to withdraw a set of greeting cards from sale because they carry shocking four-letter insults. Selfridges has withdrawn the cards after a string of complaints from visitors to their new eye-catching store in the center of Birmingham. The Church of England has also raised concerns about the crude cards, one of which included the abusive message, quote, Jesus loves everyone except you, you C blank blank blank. The cards had been on sale in full view of shoppers, including young children in the futuristic-looking store. It's just yards away from the other hot attraction in downtown Birmingham, the newly refurbished St. Martin's Church. I recommend those cards. They're very funny, but can't be read over the radio. And finally, in the apologies of the week, Jerome James is sorry he snoozed. It wasn't intentional, he said, but the Seattle Supersonics center regretted falling asleep while the team watched more than 2 hours of game footage before Monday's practice. There's no excuse for falling asleep during the team video session, James said. I apologize to my teammates. I will try my best not to let it happen again. That's not really a guarantee of wakefulness on his part. He's going to try his best, ladies and gentlemen. And that's darn good. It's good enough for me. I believe we have some reasons to be scared today. We're happy, but we're scared.
Let's get scared.
A New Zealand man who built a cruise missile in his garage claims the New Zealand government forced him to shut down his project after coming under pressure from the United States. Bruce Simpson, no relation, says he built the missile using parts bought off the internet to show how easily someone could build a cruise missile in their garage. He says he attracted considerable interest from potential buyers, including an offer from Iran to pay him for details of his research. The New Zealand government at first said I had done nothing illegal, he says Bruce Simpson. But then a U.S. official was quoted as saying it was extremely unhelpful. The authorities have finally decided to bankrupt me over a tax debt, and I've now had to give the missile to a friend for safekeeping. Although his own missile-building days have come to an end, he says he believes he's proved his point, quote, that by using off-the-shelf technology in a suburban garage, a terrorist can create a weapon against which there is no effective defense, unquote. New Zealand officials say they can't comment for reasons of secrecy. Oh, Argentina has demanded an apology. It hasn't got one yet. That's why it's not in that section of the program, from Britain after Britain admitted for the first time that Royal Navy ships carried nuclear weapons in the 1982 Falklands War. 7 nuclear weapons containers were damaged during a series of wartime accidents. Many of the details of the accidents are still being kept secret and are being hidden in a New Zealand garage. The Argentine president, Néstor Kirchner, yeah, that sounds like an Argentine. Néstor Kirchner, ladies and gentlemen, president of Argentina. What did his family do during the big one? He called for Britain to ask our forgiveness. Speaking a day after the admission, he said Argentina will stand firm in its demand for precise and accurate and complete information. British Ministry of Defense insisted there was never any intention to use the weapons during the war. No, they just shipped them 14,000 miles for fun. Their presence did not break any disarmament treaty, says the Ministry of Defense. It has refused to say whether any nuclear depth charges were on board the British warship HMS Sheffield, which was sunk during the war. That's provoked concern about nuclear contamination. Nah. A crew of workers performing... This is also reason to be scared, ladies and gentlemen, continuing our theme. A crew of workers performing sensitive repairs earlier this year at the recently reopened Pickering A nuclear plant in Canada was laid off while in the middle of the task, according to a Toronto newspaper, the Globe and Mail. The workers put down their tools, began leaving the site, and had to be asked back to tighten a plug they'd loosened in the plant's radioactive containment system. There are reports that contain unvarnished internal assessments by junior staff outlining troubles involved in refurbishing Canada's oldest atomic plant. That's Canada. The reports indicate that much of the work was so sloppy it had to be redone and that tradespeople weren't trained to reach the exacting performance standards required in the nuclear industry. The line manager's report concluded that, quote, personnel being laid off should not be assigned to work that is associated with a special safety system, unquote. Managers also recommended the company revise layoff procedures so that workers wouldn't be fired in the middle of shifts. Ladies and gentlemen, reason to be scared. But we're celebrating today here on the show.
Feeling mighty lonesome, haven't slept a wink. Wash the door and walk the floor, in between I drink black coffee, love's a hand-me-down brew. Lord, how slow the moments go, and all I do is pour black coffee since the blues caught in my eye. I'm hanging out on Monday, my not much hard to find. Black coffee, feeling low as the ground. It's driving me crazy, this waiting for my baby. Maybe come around.
This is Le Show with a salute to Al Gore's apparent injection of caffeine. He wakes up about every 3-4 months and says something, doesn't he? This was another reason to be scared, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry, it escaped the last. It leaked into this next segment of the broadcast, but it really belongs to the last one. Unbeknownst to most citizens, state officials. Here's reason really not to vote, or even to register to vote, if you needed one. If you needed another one. Unbeknownst to most citizens, state officials are selling their voter registration information to political candidates, nonprofit groups, and data collectors who then combine it with census data, purchasing histories, credit reports, and magazine subscription lists in order to fine-tune their marketing pitches to specific constituencies, such as pickup truck drivers who subscribe to Soldier of Fortune or SUV drivers who buy underwear at Victoria's Secret. Some states limit sales to political groups. 22 states lack any criteria restricting who may purchase the information. Says California Voter Foundation founder Kim Alexander, voters fill out these forms in good faith, thinking the information they're providing is needed for the purpose of administering elections. Then they get phone calls or a knock on the door from strangers who have a list of their personal data. Alexander says the information requested by many states, including Social Security numbers and mothers' maiden names, can easily be used for identity theft. This is from Wired.com. And one of the nation, also from that source, one of the nation's largest commercial distributors of voter data sold voter registration lists featuring detailed personal information without verifying the identity or the intent of the buyers. Aristotle International used a website to sell the lists. Aristotle International. They got to be smart. I trust them. I trust them more than I trust Plato International with my voting records. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for still another copyrighted feature of this broadcast, Tales of Airport Security. In tribute to all the people who are flying. Oh, by the way, it made actual network news this week that Transportation Safety Security Administration had laid off screeners just in time for the holidays. Dear Mr. Shearer, heard your show last week and the segment on airport security, so I thought you may need a bit more. On a flight to Salt Lake City from San Jose, California, my brother and I went through all the requisite security checkpoints to ensure that we were safe, including x-raying my backpack. Upon landing in Salt Lake City and finding our way to the hotel room, I went searching for my wallet in the backpack and came upon a folding knife in one of the pockets. Imagine my surprise. I promptly put it in my suitcase, confident that piece of luggage would not be in reach of me or anyone else on our return flight. It's unnerving to know you've stood in security lines for an hour and a half, only unwittingly to carry aboard a potential weapon. Listener Tom writes, here's the reverse side of security. Happened to me 3 weeks ago while doing a short consulting job in Kabul. On the way out of Kabul Airport, that's KBL for those of you who are fans of airport abbreviations, I provided a nylon wire tie from my carry-on bag to hang an intravenous drip bottle for a poor soul that was being medevaced out of Kabul on the same Air Azerbaijan airplane. We all helped get him in his stretcher on board and secured for takeoff, etc. Then they had this IV drip bottle to hang, so I pulled this nylon wire tie out of my bag and they hooked it through a hole in the overhead bin lid. It worked great. I carry them to secure suitcases and other odd jobs like this. Very handy. When we landed in Baku, Azerbaijan, 2 hours later, they then realized that we needed a knife or something to cut the wire tie to get the IV drip bottle down. Well, guess what? Security procedures meant that no one had anything that could cut the nylon wire tie. Should have called Salt Lake City, don't you think? After 15 minutes of trying everything, one guy even tried to gnaw it with his teeth, someone went to the cockpit and found a pair of pliers with enough cutting power to cut the nylon wire tie. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of the broadcast. And my favorite media memo of the week. There have been some mistaken and premature obituaries published in the New York Times. And that was just a little bit more than the editor in charge of obituaries could stand. Memo from Chuck Strum. Subject, obit attribution. Can you please distribute this today to every member of your staff, reporters, and editors alike? The day after our erroneous obit appeared, two more obits were printed without cause of death, both from the style department. Today, an obit from culture was also unattributed. So here's what everyone needs to know. Every obit must say how we know the person is dead. This is not a change in policy or style. It is a restatement. The fact of death must be attributed, although attribution of the cause in paragraph 2 will suffice. No exceptions without approval from an editor or the news desk editor in charge. Please consult me if you have questions. Thanks, Chuck. Now, my only question is, do we know for sure that that's not a Saddam lookalike? Chuck? Didn't he have a dozen of them? Might he have slipped one of them his DNA?
lots of people wait for me. Seagulls scavenge, still ice cream. Worries vanish within my dream.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is one of those everything has changed days, if you believe what you're hearing on the television, on the Yak shows and so forth. And maybe it's true, but here's some things that haven't changed. Former Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury, James Baker, a trusted member of the first Bush administration, is still supposed to be heading towards Europe this week to try to convince France, Germany, and Russia to forgive Iraqi debt, the estimated $120 billion of debt that Iraq piled up under Saddam Hussein. And here's something else that hasn't changed. The memo from Paul Wolfowitz, Under Secretary of Defense, that came out this week saying that countries that didn't provide troops for Operation Iraqi Freedom, notably France, Germany, and Russia, will not be allowed to participate in the prime contracting, the $18 billion worth of prime contracting for the reconstruction of Iraq. So while we know that there's celebration in the White House today, Sunday, one might wonder what was going on there on Saturday.
Unforgiving Eagle.
Hey, 43. Holiday greetings to you.
41. Mm. I was just talking to Condi about this. Was there ever a Christmas special on TV when I was a kid starring a woman who killed her husband?
Think so. Claudine Longine or something.
Yeah, I knew it. Mm. Condi owes me a 20.
Wait. You guys bet money?
Well, she can't buy me a beer.
Guess not. So, look, Sprout.
Yeah, so pretty neat week, huh? We rocked Mr. Chirac and gave Chancellor Schroeder a new order.
Yeah. Neat wasn't exactly my word to describe it.
Look, 41, it's been obvious to me since I first joined the 700 Club that you and I just don't see eye to eye about moral clarity. You can live without it. I can't.
Son, the whole reason people hire professionals to run their government is that we apply different standards to the lives of people and to the lives of nations. What may be helpful to a recovering alcoholic may be hurtful to
a country of alcoholics. Look, well, we're talking about a nation of beer hogs and a nation of winos. Yeah. How do you expect them to act?
Well,
Cheney and I have been fellowshipping about this. They'll act huffy in public, you know. And in private, they'll blubber like children in an AA meeting.
Now, let me do something here. Uh-huh. Jim Baker's on the other line here.
You were talking to him?
Yeah, he called me. I just conference him in here. Damn Secret Service. And the Radio Shack phone Neil has, he can do this with one button. There we go. Bake.
Mr. President, Mr. President.
Look, Jim, before you say anything, I just want you to know that whatever static you heard out of the State Department or the Treasury Department about you being my forgive-the-debt guy, none of that originated in this office.
Well,
my dad suggested you'd be willing to take on this responsibility. I didn't have a second thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, shoot, I didn't have a first thought about it. I just said, sure.
That's very kind, Mr. President, and I'm a big boy. I understand how some bureaucratic feathers can get ruffled, and there has to be some clucking while they get unruffled. I was calling your dad about a completely different matter.
Yeah, Bake really feels that the Pentagon memo stiffing the French, the Germans, and the Russians on the Iraq contracts, that just makes his job of getting debt forgiveness from the French, the Germans, and the Russians just a little
more challenging than it already
had to be.
Or was.
Yeah. And 43, I stuck up for you, said that this was just an aggressive opening gambit, that there was wiggle room in the memo for them to buy their way back into the contract stream.
Yeah.
And I was just saying that countries play poker different than people do. Mr. Putin's really feeling his oats since he staged that fake election. He's talking about making a big deal about America's historic position on debt forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Which is?
Well, we're kind of against it.
Well, sir. Moral clarity kind of makes history a little less relevant, doesn't it?
Excuse me?
Not this again.
No, that opening gambit stuff may impress the negotiating class, but if I'm a terrorist mastermind...
Uh-huh. Go with him on this.
And I see America letting the allies that stabbed us in the back get back into the game, I don't have more respect for America, I have less. See, once you look at the world through the eyes of the bad guys, it becomes real clear what the good guys ought to do.
Mr. President.
Yeah?
Not you, sir. Mr. President 43.
that's kind of a private name.
Okay. Anyway, you remember back...
See, the French and the Germans and even Putin, they know they were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What you're hearing from them now isn't anger. It's shame. And that's the first step on the road to their redemption. Now, the second step being forgiving Iraqi debtedness.
Uh-huh.
See? Told you.
Let me try this, Mr. President.
Sure.
I was talking to your dad.
Oh.
But now you.
Mm-hmm.
Look, sir, remember when you were running the Texas Rangers?
Well, making some suggestions.
And you remember how you felt about the Yankees?
Hey, us and about 23 other owners. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to call Steinbrenner Steiny. He hated that.
Okay, but the way they use their money to dominate the league, did that make you want to be more cooperative with them?
Hell no. We spent about half our time thinking about how to screw the Yankees. Of course, they're spending all their time thinking about how to screw us, so...
I think Baker is just trying to suggest we're treating the Europeans like the Yankees treated the Rangers.
You know, that's interesting.
Yeah, well...
Makes a lot of sense. You know, you start to look at things a whole different way when somebody makes a halfway decent argument instead of just... You know, flinging a bunch of facts around.
Well, the point is, sir, I got to start talking to these folks this week. Mm-hmm. And any signal I might be able to send that distances you, and by association me, from the Wolfowitz memo would be a very valuable bullet to have in my chamber.
Yeah, yeah. But see, Mr. Baker, as they used to say to me at Yale, your analogia fails. 41 says the world of nations is a different animal.
Yes, sir.
Because when you stop to think about it, there's no moral clarity in baseball.
Bake, you want to let me put you on hold for a second?
You know, I was sitting in Houston planning the law firm's Christmas party.
Yeah, I'll be right back to you, big guy. Shoot. Lost him. Look, 43, you know one thing never try to do. Is give you advice.
No, you share your wisdom.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay.
Think what Bake is trying to say in his highfalutin manner is that nobody likes a sore winner.
Hey, 41, mm-hmm. Newsflash. We're transforming the Middle East. We're in the transforming business now.
Yeah.
Who knows? A little transforming might just rub off on our European friends. But hey, big guy, you coming to Camp David for Christmas?
Think we are. Yeah. Checking with Barr tonight. She sends her love.
Back at her double. Mm. Thanks for the wisdom, 41.
You're welcome, 43.
I'd like you to meet my lawyer. Heart like a snake. Make a mistake and lawyer, bones gonna shake. Could be slander. Move to Brazil with bucks in the bank. Bucks in the bank. A beauty in love. I'd like it to meet my guru. Hey, I came from above. He'll send you a mantra when you give him your love and all your money. He'll move to Brazil with bucks in the bank. Bucks in the bank. Yeah, bucks in the bank.
I'd like it to meet my dealer. He split with my wad. You know I'd never squeal or he'd damage my bond. He cracked me aside. Could be danger. I'll move to Brazil. Forget the bucks in the bank. Bucks in the bank. Forget the bucks in the bank.
I like the thing.
Gentlemen, that's going to conclude this edition of the show. I got to go out and celebrate the capture of Saddam Hussein. So the program will return next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ Planet, WBCQ the Planet 7.415 megahertz. I bit my lip. I'm sorry there. Across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio, and around the world, girdling the globe via the Internet at two different locations on your computer whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like capturing Saddam Hussein, too, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Playlists for this broadcast are usually available at harryshearer.com. The show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Just watching that tape being rerun again. One thing we know for sure, he doesn't have head lice. That was a nice little hole he was in. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. We'll be right back.